From Georgia to New Mexico, Mississippi to Illinois, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, Ronald Reagan and Pope John Paul II both survived assassination attempts. Ronald Reagan believed their recovery was part of a divine plan. Dr. Paul Kengor from the Institute for Faith and Freedom at Grove City College has written The Divine Plan. He joins us to discuss. Congressman Mark Meadows, a leader of the Conservative Freedom Caucus, has announced his intentions to retire, but there may be a future role for him in the Trump administration. Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth has the real story. Iran, North Korea, Brexit, China, a number of foreign policy challenges await the nation in 2020. Eric Boehm from Reason Magazine is here with an overview. And our own Frank Ryan recently had a run-in with the fake news media. He gives us details on this week's American Radio Journal commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. The Divine Plan, John Paul II, Ronald Reagan, and the Dramatic End of the Cold War is a book, and now a film, authored by Dr. Paul Kengor. Paul is Executive Director of the Center for Faith and Freedom at Grove City College. He is author of a number of books and, of course, heard regularly as a commentator here on American Radio Journal. We welcome him back to discuss The Divine Plan. Paul, your book, The Divine Plan, tell us a bit about the theme of the book. It's obviously about John Paul II and Ronald Reagan. There are many aspects to the John Paul II and Ronald Reagan story. So what does your book focus on?
Well, thanks, Loman. Yeah, so these two men both believed that they were part of a divine plan, and that, you know, that divine plan was to take on and defeat atheistic Soviet communism. And they really came to that kind of acute awareness after they were both shot in 1981. Ronald Reagan was shot March 30th, 1981, John Paul II just 6 weeks later on May 13th, 1981. They barely survived. They both probably should have bled to death. You know, Ronald Reagan lost like half of his blood volume in his body. It was amazing. People have no idea how perilous it was. They both had massive blood transfusions. John Paul II, he actually received the anointing of the sick, last rites, from the priest who was with him, his close aide, Stanislav Jivich. And in fact, Loman, the first transfusion that was given to John Paul II, his body rejected it. And the medical personnel on staff at Gemelli Hospital had to open up their arms. They had to donate blood. So they both survived, and they came together a year later at the Vatican, June 1982, and Ronald Reagan was the one who said it first. He said to John Paul II that he believed that God had spared his life for a special purpose, for a divine plan. And in fact, Reagan spoke so often of the divine plan that his close aide, Bill Clark — I was Clark's biographer, so I know this really well — Reagan referred to it as the DP, the divine plan, the DP. Reagan actually had an acronym for it. And everything that I'm saying here, it's probably no surprise for people when it comes to a pope, right? Well, of course the pope believes he's operating according to a divine plan, right? He's a religious man. But Ronald Reagan believed that as well. And part of that, I think, was his kind of Presbyterian sense. He was a Presbyterian, went to the National Presbyterian Church in Washington, D.C., went to a Presbyterian church in California. But a lot of it, kind of more deeply, a kind of a broader Christianity, he had learned from the time that he was a little boy, and this was inculcated into his mind by his mom, Nell Reagan, who used to always say, "Ronnie, all the things that happen to you, the good and the bad, they're put there by a loving God according to God's plan, a divine plan, and you need to go out there and you need to find out what your plan is." So this book, and it has a film documentary by the same name, The Divine Plan, that goes along with it. And in fact, the website is thedivineplanmovie.com. But the book is like a companion book to the film, and it explores that deep theological issue and question of how these two men considered this divine plan that they believed that they were a part of.
both John Paul II, having been a cardinal from Poland, which was under Soviet communist domination, and Ronald Reagan, who made taking on the evil empire a centerpiece of his administration, both of them were already on that track, Paul, before the assassination attempts. So did the assassination attempts, it sounds to me like what you're saying is they really inspired these two individuals to accelerate the path that they were already on and believe that they were blessed to do so.
Yeah, that's well put. So both, I mean, you're right, but both were already thinking that way. You can find, I sat in the Reagan Library back in the year, wow, what was it, 2000, and went through dozens of letters from Reagan when he was governor, and in fact, when he was a private citizen, writing to different people, people who had tragedies, who had lost loved ones. I remember one that was really touching was he wrote to the widow of a police officer who had been killed. And Reagan kind of fell right into this sort of divine plan theology where he said, you know, I know that this doesn't make a lot of sense, I'm sure, to you right now when you're hurting, but there's a reason for this. And you know, and it, if you're faithful, you good can come from this. You know, I'm sorry for your loss, but there's a way that good can come from this. So they both always had that kind of strong divine sense, but with Reagan in particular, after he was shot, and he told Michael Deaver, he told his son Michael Reagan, he told Mother Teresa, Terence Cardinal Cook, he told the Reverend Louis Evans, his pastor at the National Presbyterian Church in Washington, who I interviewed. When he came back from the hospital, George Washington University Hospital, especially that Good Friday week, that Holy Week in April 1981, he started telling people, he said, you know, I was really lucky, and I think there must be a reason why I was saved. And he even told Deaver, he told Michael Deaver, I just have this sense, Mike, that there's a reason for this, that I'm being called to something even bigger. And he believed that it was that confrontation against Soviet communism. And then imagine, Loman, so he's thinking that around Good Friday, mid-April 1981, and then just 4 weeks after that, this Polish Pope, and I talk about this a lot in the book, we talk about this a lot in the film, when Reagan in October 1978 saw that the Vatican picked the first non-Italian Pope in 455 years, the first Slavic Pope ever, the first Polish Pope ever, and plucked him, you know, right smack out of the middle of the communist bloc. And Reagan always had this special affinity for Poland, of all things. The Hitler-Stalin Pact, what happened in World War II. So for Reagan already thought that John Paul II being picked by the conclave during that period. Of course, Reagan wasn't Catholic, but his brother was, his father was. He already thought that was part of God's providence. So to have Reagan survive an assassination attempt, and then 4 weeks later to see John Paul II survive one, and get this, Loman, this is kind of neat. 4 days after the shooting of John Paul II, so this would have been May 17th, 1981, Ronald Reagan's first public speech was at Notre Dame. In the United States, he was given the commencement speech at Notre Dame, which, of course, Reagan saw as part of the DP, part of the divine plan. And Reagan even talked there about our prayers are with the Holy Father, right? Our prayers are with this Pope. So all this stuff that eventually happened in the 80s, the fall of the Berlin Wall, everything else, you know, here were two men committed to this, you know, this path of faith and freedom, who believed that they were called to that special purpose.
In addition to the book, The Divine Plan, as you referenced earlier, there is a movie. You and your co-author, Rob Orlando, have put this movie together. Tell us a little bit about the film, and is it available now for folks to see in the theater, on demand? How can folks get to see the movie, the film, The Divine Plan?
Yeah, you got to see it. It's really beautifully done. Rob Orlando went out and interviewed 14 different people, basically all the leading biographers of Ronald Reagan and John Paul II. It is available as a video. It's available on demand, and also it's now being sold as a DVD on Amazon as well. I think those are pre-orders. But for more information on all of that, just go to the website, which is thedivineplanmovie.com, thedivineplanmovie.com.
We have again been talking with Dr. Paul Kengor. He's with the Institute for Faith and Freedom at Grove City College, and you hear him frequently here on American Radio Journal as one of our commentators, co-author of The Divine Plan, John Paul II, Ronald Reagan, and The Dramatic End of the Cold War, both a book and a movie. Paul, thank you for being here.
Oh, thanks so much, and I love American Radio Journal. I'm so proud to be part of it. Thanks, Loman.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth, taking a look at an entire new year on Capitol Hill, but a lot of old business. Scott, good to have you here.
Thanks. Happy New Year, Loman.
Well, Happy New Year to you as well. And interestingly, Scott, the old year rang out with one of the leading conservative pro-growth lights in the U.S. House of Representatives announcing his retirement. Tell us what the story is with Mark Meadows.
Yeah, so I think a lot of people have come to know the name Mark Meadows as a household name in politics. He was the second chairman of the House Freedom Caucus and really elevated that group during the era of President Trump to being a major force when it came to the big policy and political battles occurring on Capitol Hill. Mark Meadows was one of the president's top defenders during the House impeachment process and has led many years of service on the House Oversight Committee. He also was instrumental in removing Speaker Boehner from his speakership back in 2015, which led to Paul Ryan. And so, you know, obviously there's a lot of different people that have had sort of their fingerprints on the big efforts that have been happening on Capitol Hill. But in terms of the conservative movement, Mark Meadows has been a big, big champion and will certainly be missed when he retires from the House. So he's announced he's not seeking re-election, and there's obviously some rumors going around in Washington that Meadows may be pulled into the Trump administration in a senior capacity. The Club for Growth would obviously support that. We think that no matter what he does following his time in Congress, he can be really effective for the conservative movement.
Certainly a voice that will be missed on Capitol Hill, but hopefully some of those rumors pan out and he will continue to play a major role in Washington. Let's talk for a couple of minutes now about Congress and the agenda that they are going to have here throughout 2020. Scott, it appears that impeachment is going to continue to dominate and take all of the oxygen out of the air on Capitol Hill, at least for the next month or two. How do you see that unfolding?
Yeah, right now the Senate is waiting on Nancy Pelosi to send the articles of impeachment over to the Senate. And until she does that, I think that Mitch McConnell and Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi are sort of in a behind-the-scenes negotiation on what that process looks like in the Senate. The timeline certainly is going to dominate all of January. Congress returns. And in addition to that, once impeachment is concluded, you're going to see the U.S.-Mexico-Canada trade agreement go through the Senate. So that'll kind of be the only big policy initiative heading into the early months of 2020. It's kind of odd to say 2020, but here we are. We're in an election year, and I think that that's the bottom line. This is going to be electoral politics for everything that's going on in Capitol Hill. It's going to be a battle to win the Senate for Chuck Schumer. It's going to be a battle to fire Nancy Pelosi for the House. And overall, there's going to be a lot of really competitive races. We're certainly going to be engaged in many, many races. We've already made a number of endorsements that I've previously told your listeners about. And it's an exciting time. I think that there is new leadership willing to step up to the plate and be effective in Washington. So even though we're losing somebody like Mark Meadows from the halls of Congress, I do think that there's exciting, brand new conservatives that are going to be coming into the fold. And there's other conservatives that are currently serving that will be reelected and have the ability to step up and do even more.
President Trump has already branded this Democrat-controlled House of Representatives as a do-nothing Congress. And as you've just outlined it, other than USMCA, it doesn't appear that Congress is really going to get anything done in 2020. Does that not play into his hand?
Yeah, I mean, I think it does help him. He's got a number of economic successes through his deregulatory agenda, through the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, the economy is doing really well, the stock market is doing well. When the American people have that kitchen table conversation, they're going to talk about their bottom line. And the reality is that unemployment is at historic lows, labor force participation is increased, and wages are increasing. Overall, people are definitely in a better position than they were 4 years ago underneath the liberal policies of Barack Obama. So, you know, you're already kind of seeing some of the mainstream media trying to say, oh, who are the Democrat candidates that can attract independents and these Republicans that are opposed to President Trump? Well, to be honest, they've all lurched so far to the left over the last year or so since this race got underway that I think it's insincere if anybody says that they're actually going to work to continue some of the good things that President Trump has done. So I don't really see any moderate emerging. I think that Joe Biden is still a liberal, and his campaign is also fluttering. We'll see what that looks like heading into Iowa, New Hampshire, South Carolina, and Florida. But we're definitely in a situation here where the stakes are really, really high for 2020. And if we want to continue to have a strong economy, I think the choice is pretty clear. And that means electing more economic conservatives to the House, strong liberty-minded economic conservatives in the Senate, and obviously reelecting President Trump.
We have been talking with Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. And Scott, as always, tell us a bit about the club.
The Club for Growth is a membership organization. And if your listeners are interested in checking us out on our website, it's www.clubforgrowth.org. And our social media, Twitter, is at Club for Growth with the number 4.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, thank you for being here.
Thanks, Loman.
The economy dominates in presidential election years, but foreign affairs can be a wild card. With a look at the foreign policy challenges that lie ahead, we turn to Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine.
The foreign policy experts have seen the shadow of American empire, and so that means more war is likely on the way. Yes, welcome to Groundhog Day, Endless War Edition. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. And let me be probably the last to wish you a happy new year. No guest for me this week on the show. Instead, I'm taking a look at what foreign policy experts say is likely on tap for U.S. foreign policy, military policy in particular, in the new year here in 2020. Now, there's an annual survey that's conducted by the Council on Foreign Relations in which foreign policy experts are asked to rank about 30 potential conflicts that could require American military action in the new year. And this year, the brave men and women of the foreign policy establishment say that only two of those 30 conflicts have a low likelihood of occurring. In other words, they say that there's a pretty good chance that something happens on 28 other fronts around the world. Paul Stairs, the director of the Council of Foreign Relations Center for Preventative Action, says that this is perhaps an indication of rising concern about the state of the world. Respondents are rating more threats as likely to require a U.S. military response in 2020 than in any previous year when this same study has been done. And indeed, the year has already gotten off to something of a violent start around the world. Protesters stormed the U.S. embassy in Baghdad during the final hours of 2019 and into early 2020. They are protesting American airstrikes against Iranian-backed militia groups that are operating in what's left of Iraq at this point. In response to those protests, President Donald Trump deployed 750 additional American troops to Baghdad, and reportedly the White House is considering sending another 4,000 troops into the Middle East, potentially to deter Iran from stirring up more trouble. The worrying thing about all this, of course, is that it could be a prelude to an actual war with Iran. Once again, it seems like we're constantly on the potential precipice of that conflict. Both Donald Trump and his former national security advisor, John Bolton, and of course, you'll remember that the two of them rarely saw eye to eye when they worked together, but now both of them have pinned the blame for this week's Baghdad protests on Iran or on Iranian-backed rebels. But there are still plenty of reasons, of course, for Iraqis to be angry with America's continued presence in their country now well over 15 years after we toppled Saddam Hussein. The potential for conflict with Iran really stands out in the Council for Foreign Relations survey as well. Only one conflict is ranked as the potential for having a high impact on the United States, and that's an armed confrontation between Iran and the U.S. or one of its close allies, the think tank reports. Alongside potential war with Iran, the group also lists 12 other conflicts that are, quote, identified as top priorities for the United States next year. And I think calling them top priorities is probably a bit misleading, right? I mean, it's not like these are goals that the United States is setting and trying to achieve, New Year's resolutions, if you will. But among what the Council for Foreign Relations calls top priorities include a major terrorist attack on the United States or a close ally, a crisis on the Korean Peninsula, or potentially a maritime conflict with China in the South China Sea, along with the potential for increased Russian aggression in Ukraine and additional strife in Central America. Still, 2020 does seem like it could be a particularly fraught year for America's foreign policy. Iraq is certainly a mess, and the most realistic outcome in Afghanistan at this point is that Washington will eventually have to turn the country over to the Taliban, you know, the same group that America's been fighting for 19 years. And despite two decades of failed interventions, there will always be esteemed people in the foreign policy think tank world calling for America to shed more blood and treasure over conflicts that honestly have little to do with keeping Americans safe. The Council for Foreign Relations survey this year certainly makes that much clear. The wild card in all of this? Well, as usual, it's President Donald Trump. Although he has so far avoided outright war with Iran and not given in to the siren call of further conflicts elsewhere in the world, he's also failed to follow through on his promises about ending America's long-term engagements in the Middle East and bringing the troops home. And now, as he gears up to run for re-election, it's not difficult to imagine the foreign policy establishment in D.C. whispering in his ear that another foreign war could be good for his domestic political prospects. After all, the country rallies around presidents at times of war. But I think believing that would be a mistake. For one thing, Americans are weary of war, and I don't think the old adage about people flocking together and following a leader, a strong leader, into a conflict is necessarily true anymore. Because I think Trump got elected in 2016 in large part because he ran against America's bipartisan foreign policy consensus. Voters picked him over both a Bush and a Clinton, after all. And if his reelection campaign is going to tout promises kept as its slogan, and that's what they're doing so far, then he probably can't afford to break one of his big 2016 promises by launching another new war or a war with Iran. And for that matter, the country can't afford it either. We're $23 trillion in debt, and as we've learned over the past two decades, these wars aren't cheap. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm. You can check out everything we are following regarding Trump's re-election campaign, regarding the ongoing policy fights in Washington, D.C., and of course, foreign policy as well at Reason.com. I'll be back here next week with a guest. But for now, Happy New Year, and I'll catch you next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
Colonel Frank Ryan, USMC retired, serves as a Pennsylvania state representative. Before Christmas, he had his own experience with the faulty reporting of some in the mainstream news media. He relays the story on this American Radio Journal commentary.
Imagine the headlines. Pennsylvania representative responsible for Senator Kamala Harris dropping out of the presidential race just 3 days after Senator Harris posted an article that was grossly inaccurate about a bill that I had introduced in the Pennsylvania legislature. She dropped out of her presidential race. I was ecstatic that my controversial bill, which should not have been controversial at all, forced an end to her presidential dreams. Seriously, though, I was no more responsible for her dropping out of the race than she was accurate in describing my fetal remains bill. Fake news. I've heard President Trump make comments about fake news for almost 4 years now. Until recently, however, I had no idea how serious a problem fake news really is. By way of background, I am a current member of the Pennsylvania House of Representatives. The setting for this story is quite benign. I introduced a bill, House Bill 1890, the Fetal Remains Bill, whose only purpose was to allow a parent who had lost a child through miscarriage or stillbirth to have the remains at their own expense to inter or cremate. I've had three children that have lost and are in heaven. My bill on fetal remains is similar to an Indiana law that the United States Supreme Court found to be constitutional this year by a 7-2 vote. My experience with fake news started almost immediately after the hearing about the bill in committee. First, a Democrat member of the Pennsylvania House made national news in reference to her comment that a miscarriage is nothing more than a mess on a napkin. She reluctantly seemed to apologize after public outcry, even from the left. At the same time, one member of the press latched onto some misleading information from a pro-abortion group and published a story that was grossly inaccurate, saying that the bill mandated death certificates and funerals. None of that is in my three-page bill. Fake news. It seemed that in just days after the committee vote, I had managed to alienate Planned Parenthood, a Rolling Stone magazine reporter, the progressive wing of the Democratic Party, and Senator Kamala Harris. Not a bad track record for a relatively new member of the House. The article that was originally published has since been updated after I got wind of the article. I responded to critics of my bill and sent them a link to a three-page bill which clarified the real objective of the bill to create the voluntary program for grieving parents to take care of the remains of stillbirth or miscarriage. After public backlash, the reporter met with me and our staff, and we refuted almost the entire original article. The article was revised, but the original article was not retracted per se. Incidentally, to be fair, the reporter reached out to me before publication, and I called her back immediately, but she indicated conveniently that she never received my message until after the article was published. After the initial outrage, the bill went to the full House for a vote, and it passed with a bipartisan vote of 123-76. Despite the language in the bill to the contrary, some members of the House continued the charade of mischaracterizing what the bill allowed despite continued correction. Fake news. Then the fun really started. Almost immediately, two articles were published which parroted the inaccurate information from the first article. Neither reporter called me for a comment. Hate mail started coming in, and I responded to as many as I could. The people who saw the article that I was able to respond to were overwhelmingly supportive of my bill after they saw the language in my bill. But the left continued. Senator Kamala Harris forwarded the article on Facebook, further causing some minor comments that I also responded to. Again, once people saw what the bill really did, most responded favorably. One person even posted the following, and I quote, "To individuals who are emotionally charged by PIE House Bill 1890, please read our exchange of comments. Information is healthy and emotions are real. Please be informed before you make an emotional outburst like I did today," end quote. Apparently, the left did not anticipate that I would respond to the comments and defend my bill, and hence the fake news is alive, and it is not well. The damage that is done by such irresponsible, agenda-driven reporting, and I quote, reporting, is remarkable. The damage, though, is not done to me, to President Trump, or others so affected, but it is to the very premise of the First Amendment of the Constitution. Freedom of the press is a right we should all cherish. Responsibility of the press is what we should all demand. Trump understands what the press does not. He understands that the vast majority of Americans cherish freedom of the press but condemn the irresponsibility of the press. There are outstanding reporters, however. In my own case on this bill, one reporter contacted me and said, "This article about your bill does not sound like you. Can you explain it?" I did, and she reported on the bill. To this day, I have no idea whether or not she supports the bill, but what I do understand is that she, the reporter who came to interview me, and the entire station cherish accuracy and trust. That is the true freedom of the press, and that should be cherished. For the American Radio Journal, this is Frank Ryan.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including WGFP-AM in Webster, Massachusetts, KCHW-FM in Chewelah, Washington, along with WIBW-AM and FM in Topeka, Kansas. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.